A great day, comrades. We sail into history.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And this time we're going to be talking about The Hunt for Red October, the 1984 novel by Tom Clancy, and the 1990 movie directed by John McTiernan and starring Sean Connery and Alec Baldwin, among others. Right off the top here, I do want to say that we have no idea what the audio is going to be like this time, because we're recording in a particular location, an undisclosed location at this time, and if you ask the authorities, they will deny that any of this ever happened.
No. Somewhere in the North Atlantic.
I'm going to show you my identification. This never happened. Yeah. I was not here.
We are closer to the Pacific, though.
True.
And you have already heard that that we have a couple of guests. This time we're recording with six people, which we've never done, mostly because we only have four microphones, but we're doing it anyway. Guests that you will recognize are Peter Kusky and Tim Kusky, Colin's sons. So, hi, Peter.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, good.
Hi, this is Tim.
Yep.
Glad to be on again.
Good to have you. And then we have one other guest, and I'm going to throw it over to Colin to talk about exactly how this all happened, because it's all your fault, meaning you get all the credit, dang it, for setting this up. And introduce our other guest.
Okay. Well, technically speaking, this is not all my fault. It's actually my son Tim's fault, because way back in March, I got him a pass to the OMSI Science Fiction Film Festival. And we had a ton of fun. We watched, 23 different movies, which means we only saw about two-thirds or half of them. And as part of that, I got to wondering how the entire festival was set up. How do you choose the movies? How do you physically get them? What is the history of this like? And so I got a hold of Russ Rep from OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, and I had him on with Phil Nichols and I on Science Fiction 101, my other podcast. And it was a great interview. Time passes. We start talking about our December podcast. It went through four different iterations.
Right. It was supposed to be October, then November, and now it's December.
Yes. The Hunt for Red October, The Hunt for Red November.
The branding was on spot for Hunt for October in October.
Yes.
But then, of course, the October resolution was actually our November. So that was going to work out, too. But then it became Christmas, because guess what? It's a Christmas book.
It's a Christmas movie. Yeah. It takes place 2 weeks in December. I'm getting ahead of myself. That's a lot kind of stuff. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could record the podcast for The Hunt for Red October in a submarine that was in the movie The Hunt for Red October? And so I sent an email to the OMSI general line. They routed it to Russ Rep. And I think it was probably, all downhill from there. He knew that we would come in and do a great job and talk about OMSI and the Blueback. And then Tim M. from the OMSI submarine team got involved, and he is here with us today. He also has a podcast, and I would love for you to tell us about your podcast so that we can know more about that too when it comes to the right point. That wasn't that awkward.
We're on a submarine. Yeah. How cool is that?
We're on a submarine. So we're sitting here in the wardroom for the SS Blueback with Tim M. as our chaperone and expert guest on the Blueback. So I'm interested to hear what we hear from James and Tim about, nuclear submarines, diesel submarines. Can you tell us a little bit about the Blueback, how it got here, and what your role here is?
Absolutely. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim McGaughey. I am the supervisor on USS Blueback here at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. So a little bit about Blueback. Blueback is a Barbell-class submarine, one of three that were actually constructed, the other two boats being the Barbell and the Bonefish. These were all commissioned in 1959. They served for roughly 30 years. Blueback herself is the very last diesel electric attack submarine in the U.S. Navy. She was decommissioned in 1990, serving for 31 years. And the Barbell class is also unique because they are the first production attack submarines in the Navy with what is called a teardrop-shaped hull. So when you think of submarines, you probably envision these big black steel tubes. And it all actually started with the Barbell class, well, technically with the earlier experimenter submarine Albacore, but these are the first production submarines to have this particular shape. And the shape itself is what makes it very hydrodynamically efficient, very quiet, and much faster underwater than previous fleet boat submarines that were used in World War II.
Cool. So how long have you been here on the Blueback?
I joined the Blueback crew in July of 2023. And before that, we've had quite a number of turnover of tour guides. COVID kind of shut the OMSI and the boat down for quite a while. And so we have been struggling to kind of build our numbers back up, particularly in our volunteer tour guides. And anyway, I saw there was an opening. I tried initially in 2022, but I did not get the job. And then I reapplied again the next year when I saw the opening come up. And I got lucky and they decide to bring me on board. So the crew itself is composed of people from different walks of life. Some are submarine veterans. Others, like me, are not. We're surface sailors, and others completely have no background whatsoever in military services. One of them is a geologist by trade. Another spent his whole life in like arts and presentation, things like that. So they bring a lot of different perspectives on giving tours on the submarine, which is what we're all about here.
Cool. And you do submarine tours here daily, except on Mondays.
So usually we do multiple tours an hour, and basically our whole job is to give quote unquote interpretive tours. We go from place to place, compartment to compartment inside the submarine, and just give you an idea of what the history of this place was, what some objects and artifacts on the submarine were. And a lot of the tours focused on just what life on a submarine was like. So, and a lot of people might think like, oh, well, shouldn't you have been a submariner to do that? Well, not necessarily. Okay, so you might have been a submariner, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're a tour guide. So we just have to learn a lot of the knowledge. So I like to think that I know just enough about submarines to make me dangerous, so that's about all I can say about that.
And there's another level of tour, a technical tour, and it's done twice a month?
We currently opened up technical tours for 3 times a month. Those occur on Sundays, and those tours are what I like to call the 3-hour deep dive into the submarine. They are specifically guided by submarine veterans and the volunteers, and basically, it's heavily dependent on what questions are asked. So I've heard of a technical tour that goes upwards of 8 hours, although we will not force anyone to be on that tour. But the average is about 3 hours. I've seen some that go like 4, maybe 4.5 hours, but it's heavily dependent on what questions people ask. We have a lot of Navy and submarine veterans on those tours, and we recommend everyone who's interested in a technical tour take the regular tour first to get an idea. And if you want more, sign up for a tech tour, but book early because the tours are limited to 6 people on a tour. You have to be 12 or older to be on them, and they fill up fast. I think currently, as of mid-December of 2024, they're booked up through the end of the year.
Wow. Yeah. And so you do have a podcast of your own. Can you tell me a little bit about it, where we can find it, and what you talk about on there?
Absolutely. Actually, in a way, it kind of ties into my blog, Fair Winds and Following Seas, which can be found at thetidesofhistory.com. And I focus on maritime and naval history on that blog, amongst various other things, as well as wargaming and things like that. But upon coming aboard Blueback, I realized I wanted to get the word out more and try and kind of, in a sense, increase publicity and further our stories as tour guides. So the podcast I created was Down Periscope, Up Periscope, Tales of Submarine Tours. And it's just a compilation of all funny kind of sea stories and our own perspective as tour guides on what it's like to be giving tours on Blueback and the history and submarine history in general.
Cool. And where will we find that?
It can be found on, I broadcast it to Spotify. It's on YouTube as well, and several other platforms. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's out there. Just search Down Periscope, Up Periscope, and you should be able to find it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for being here, Tim. And so normally the stuff we cover is like, history with the material, maybe history with Tom Clancy. So Colin, any history you want to talk about?
I think I came across the book first after I watched the movie. Mm. So, heard that it was a movie, saw it, thought it was totally awesome, mm-hmm. heard that it was adapted from a book. And so started reading. And then I think the summer of 1993, I read everything Clancy had written that summer up until that point.
Yeah. That's kind of similar to my story. I mean, I discovered that I went to the movie first in the theater. I imagine you did as well.
Yeah.
And then, and my dad was a big Clancy fan. So he had a whole shelf full of novels. And so I read 7 or 8 of them, starting in like 1994, and eventually I caught up with him. And then I got to the point where I read the new one and went, that kind of sucked. I'm going to stop reading this. And that one was The Bear and the Dragon, by the way. That was the one that made me jump off and go, I don't know. What about you, James?
I do not have any history of this novel, actually. Just the movie from way back when.
Okay. No other Clancy either?
Not really. No, I was more into more science fiction than that is sure. Science fiction.
So. You were too busy being aboard an actual submarine.
Yeah, basically.
Now, what about Rainbow Six? Did you ever play that?
The video games.
Yes. So there you go.
Okay, there you go.
Ghost
okay.
Recon. Okay. Yeah.
Ghost Recon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Those are both Clancy novels.
That's touche.
Clancy properties.
Properties, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. How about you, Peter?
I have a fairly interesting history with this. So I first watched this movie when I was homesick from school in the second grade. It was the edited for TV version. AMC. Yes. There's an edited for TV version of the Hunt for Red October.
What did they edit out?
I'll give you one guess, James.
That's fair enough.
Couple naughty words.
Speaking of that, right. So I watched this movie, absolutely loved it. And then a year or so later, I think, I found it at the elementary school garage sale, the VCR version. Take it home, was super excited for that. We watched it, and it's the not edited for TV version, including all of the Navy swears. Mm-hmm. So...
So the way sailors normally talk.
Exactly. I think I picked up the book when I was in high school, and I think I've read it once a year since then. I love this book.
All right. How about you, Cusky Tim?
Yeah, so I was present for that home viewing of The Hunt for Red October, uncensored, right? And we absolutely loved the movie, but while we were watching it, Dad looked over at us and said very sternly, "If I ever hear you two say any of these words."
Yep.
Pretty much. And I've been watching The Hunt for Red October frequently over the years. It's probably one of my top rewatched films, just because I enjoy it so much. I've seen it on multiple different screens, including OMSI's Empirical Theater, the big IMAX. Saw that about 10 years ago.
Nice.
I hadn't read the novel... I think I tried to read the novel when I was in middle school or high school and did not get very far through it. I did read Patriot Games when I was in high school, but the first time I read the novel all the way through was in preparing for this podcast, which I read in August.
Nice. And then OMSI, Tim, I know that you blogged about the book, and so I know that you've read it. And it sounds like your history is similar with Tim, where you tried to read it at some point and gave up.
Yeah, it is very similar in a way. I must have tried to read the book. I can't remember when. It must have been the late 90s, early 2000s when I was a teenager and just thought, oh, this is way too technical. I got like 40 pages into the book and like just put it down. But my parents were like, oh, you got to read it. You've seen the movie. You like the movie. So you got to read the book. So, but of course, coming on Blueback, I'm like, well, maybe I should actually get around to reading this book. And I've already been familiar with other Clancy properties, like the video games, like Rainbow Six and Splinter Cell and all that. So but I knew of Tom Clancy and the fact that he is more than just an author now. He is basically a franchise of multiple things.
Right.
But whether or not how close they are to Clancy's vision is debatable. But we got to go back to the original, the very first Clancy property here, Hunt for October. So I got the book. We have a copy, of course, on our boat right here. And I thought, you know what? I'll just read it. So I did.
Nice.
And so then, is that the boat copy of The Hunt for October? Is that your copy?
It's the boat copy.
Boat copy.
Wow. That is cool. A well-used copy of the book.
That is a very well-used copy.
Okay, I just got to smell it.
Oh, yeah. So is there a particular reason why we were interested in doing this on the Blueback?
Because it's a submarine?
It's a submarine.
Well, it's in the movie for a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, come on, guy.
Yes.
We already explained that. You want to tell us about that, Tim?
Yeah, so... there's been a lot of myths, and there's a big piece of Blueback lore that this boat itself, Blueback, was in the film, and she is, but I'm saving that for my own YouTube video and podcast episode. But I will say that Blueback's claim to fame in The Hunt for October lasts all of 4 seconds. It is a single shot taken in our torpedo room. There are three sailors. The way the story was told to me is that these guys, the Blueback was still in service at the time, and they needed a submarine, from what I understand, with like 6 torpedo tubes, and they're all in the bow, in the front of the submarine. So they paid these Blueback sailors $50 each, shaved their heads, dressed them in Soviet uniforms, they taught them some Russian naval songs, and then they filmed a bunch of stuff, which was eventually cut from the film, and Blueback's blink and you miss it scene.
That's too bad.
Is when Captain Ramish is talking to his crew and he's saying we're going to Havana, Cuba, and all that. And there's a shot of Blueback in there. If you didn't know what you were looking at, you wouldn't realize it. Blink, you miss it.
Right.
Nice. We'll get a shot of that later on.
Yeah.
I got to be honest, that is an A+ Sean Connery impression.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you had previously read the book. I'd previously read the book.
Yeah.
Peter had. You know, how, Colin, for you, how did it hold up on a reread? Because this is, I think I've talked about, you know, I'm not the hugest fan of like hard science fiction, right?
Yeah.
Where the technical detail on a reread, I start going, oh, get back to the plot. So for me, it was a bit of a slog in places, but what about for you?
That's the thing. That's part of the thing that I love. That's why up until recently, I reread The Martian every year because I love those details. I love how the details in this book kind of flesh it out and give it a sense of realism. Although a lot of what Clancy talked about in here apparently was wrong, and the Navy knew it was wrong, and they decided to let it go because it made the Navy look better than it actually was. A little more threatening, great propaganda.
Mm. Right.
Yeah, so when they talk about the capabilities of the ships and the tactical abilities and everything else they do, I love that.
Yeah. The interesting thing is the book was published first by the Naval Institute Press.
Yeah.
Which I can't remember what book it was that was published first in whatever the, like the Chilton's guides, you know, the company that made the Chilton, the automotive guides.
Yeah.
I think it was Dune, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah, it was Dune. I just Googled it.
By Chilton's Manual.
Yeah.
Same publisher.
Yeah. Couldn't publish it anywhere else. And then eventually, you know, it gets bought by another studio. And I think something like that happened with The Hunt for Red October. So let's see. So James, first read for you, though you have been in a submarine. What did you think?
Oh, I enjoyed it. I appreciate it for the same reason, Colin. I think I appreciate all the technical aspects because being a submariner and then hearing all that stuff, and then all the different naval operations and the things they go through. And I'm sure some of it was bunk, but it was still fun. I think by the time I got to the end of the book, I could see where they could eliminate a bunch of stuff, move the puzzle along. Because there's plenty of all of that other technical stuff. A lot of it could probably have been chopped up and chopped off and make the book, you know, more streamlined or whatever. But I think if you're nerdy enough, it's pretty fun.
Yeah. So. Evidently, his original draft was longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, 100
extra pages. When I read that, I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a version of that somewhere. Line run someplace. Yeah.
Peter, so what do you think about it on a reread? You said you read it somewhat frequently.
Yes, I read this book way too frequently, probably. It's probably the top read book I have in the Nook.
Okay.
I absolutely adore this book. I know the big knock against it is that there is way too much exposition at times. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I love this book is because, especially someone who watched the movie before reading the book fleshed out how tense this whole thing was, especially as someone who didn't grow up during the Cold War.
Mm.
The movie, I don't think, does a good job of selling how tense the relations are between, and all these, like your A plot, these are probably like L, M, N, O, P plots. Where it's just like a 6-page story involving 2 fighter jets that make you realize somebody pulls a trigger too early. This thing is going boom on many different places.
Now, that's an interesting point, just because, James and Colin and I, I mean, maybe not James so much, because I think, you know, the Berlin Wall fell before you were out of grade school.
Yeah.
Colin and I don't need...
I still remember watching it on TV, though.
Yeah, yeah. But like, we don't need the context for knowing how tense things were.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we were aware.
I do read all of the rainiest lines in Sean Connery's voice, though, because I watched the movie first.
Yes.
I just enjoy the book. It's a lot of fun to read for me.
Okay. And, you know, I would compare it, like, if you're somebody who really likes a book like Rendezvous with Rama, right? A science fiction book that is long on technical details, very short on... Well, what about the humans? You know,
they're humans.
Clancy's definitely that way. Tim, you had something to say.
I was going to say that it's the book gets very technical and exposits a lot, not just on the technical details, although that definitely is a huge part of the book. But it also, as soon as you meet a character, you do get a very long biography.
A dossier.
And that's basically the way that Tom Clancy allows you to get to know the characters. It's not through any of the narrative styles of like seeing characters reveal their personality through the choices they make.
Sure. Right.
It's a lot of tell, not a lot of show.
Exactly.
Yeah. You say that.
Yeah. So in some ways it kind of reminds me of historical biographical books that I've read, like Unbroken or Flags of Our Fathers.
Mm. Contact.
There is one thing that really annoys me throughout the book, which is kind of what I see as a self-indulgent impulse in Tom Clancy to use all of the fancy new toys. Like he uses the new DSRV, and he has a fascination with the Concorde and the two-seat Harriers. And It kind of annoys me.
How much Navy stuff will stick against the wall? Exactly.
It's definitely a book for the military nerd.
Yeah. And my dad was a huge fan of a huge World War II naval history buff. That was his thing.
Cool.
And so he had biographies of Nimitz and stuff. He would have read Jack Ryan's books. Oh, so right?
Did he get pissed off about the Halsey derision?
Yeah, maybe. I want to get some more from Omzi Tim here about what do you think of the novel? I have read your review of it, so I know some of it. But for our listeners,
yeah, I thought the novel was good. I think it definitely kind of shows that this was Clancy's first novel, because I'm currently reading Red Storm Rising. His third or fourth novel. And his writing has definitely matured in that book. But the first book, I did find, there's a lot of kind of exposition to it. I think the conversations the characters have is a little bit sparse in a way. It's very economical, but in a way, if you look at it from the view of that's kind of how a lot of military people talk. The language is designed to get information across fairly efficiently. So it's meant to be like that, but a normal Jack Ryan working in a cubicle in the CIA just talking like this, it sounds a bit odd. And much like other people, it's like I cannot, having been more familiar with the movie initially, I cannot hear the characters speak in anything other than their actors' voices. So I hear James Earl Jones as Admiral Greer, and I hear Connery as Ramius, and Scott Glenn as Mancuso, and so on and so forth. So.
Yes.
But overall, the book is, I think Clancy is trying to stick all the new fancy Navy technology in it.
Yeah.
I think there's some stuff that could kind of be excised from the book, even in its final draft form. It maybe drags on a little bit in some places, but overall, it's a really good effort.
Yeah. And much as I don't usually care for this kind of novel on a reread, at least I will say that I do think it's kind of a remarkable first novel, because it's quite an accomplishment to tell as interesting a story, even with all the extra technical details. It's still pretty amazing that this was his first novel.
Yeah.
And definitely in the later books, and when I started to jump off him, I started to go, nobody talks like this, and it's not like the Aaron Sorkin nobody talks like this, where it's really fun to listen to. It's the, did AI write this?
Ouch. Yeah. So this being Tom Clancy's first book, and we talk about The Martian a lot being Andy Weir's first book, which one do you think is a better book between the two authors? A better first book?
I think Mark Watney is a more interesting character than any of the characters in The Hunt for Red October.
Absolutely.
And so I would probably give the edge to The Martian.
Okay.
The humor that he ends up injecting in that really goes a long way.
Yeah, and there was never a cut for TV version of that, so my boys were safe.
they were old enough, they didn't need it.
Yeah, compared to The Martian, in this book, the characters definitely take a back seat. But in that way, the book is definitely a real feat. It's his exploration of the strategy is clearly very well thought out, and it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
But it is a little bit like homework in some spaces.
Yes. Yeah. I do feel like you could put up a big map and you could put pins where everything is and you could move them through the entire thing.
Yeah. The attention to detail is amazing.
Well, and regarding character development, I agree with you guys that character development can be a nice part of a story. This story takes place over 13 days?
18 days.
Yeah. It's hard to evolve a character over 18 days. You can put a lot of action into 18 days,
right?
But not so much, character development and personal change and other things.
Well, it doesn't have to necessarily come from personal change, right? It's just the thing, if I had to diagnose what's the issue with why the characters aren't super interesting, is the book keeps moving off of them.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't spend too much time on
the main character of this book?
I'd say there are at least two.
There's at least two, right? And definitely in the movie, you kind of have two in a box kind of for the main character of Ramius and Ryan, right? Well, and in the movie, I can name probably 10 or 12 characters. I don't know how many characters.
There's an ensemble cast.
Yeah. But it's less of an ensemble and more of a, this person pops up. This person who is job pops up, does job, and disappears.
Yes.
Yeah.
My favorite one is the supply officer loading bombs onto the sub and then taking a full paragraph to say, this guy looked up the designation afterwards and didn't like what he read. And that's the full description it gives.
Yeah. Yeah.
This book is kind of unique. So it was the kind of like Neuromancer. It's a book that launched an entire genre, which was military pop lit.
Yeah.
It sold 5 million copies since its inception.
This might be like the second best selling book that we've ever done after Jaws.
It could be. Yeah. And it made one of the 100 best books ever on PBS list. And there's a lot of books we'd recognize on there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So if you don't know about The Hunt for Red October, we could talk about it really briefly. I mean,
sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will try to summarize. If I fail, you got my back, James?
Summarize, please. Summarize.
So concise. A CIA analyst goes to Washington, D.C. because the British have found some pictures of an odd Russian submarine. Now, this Russian submarine has just left, and everyone's curious about it. And then while they begin to track it, it disappears off of sonar. They can't hear it any longer. And it comes out, this was built by the Russians as a potential first strike weapon against the United States with a completely silent drive that can park its nuclear missiles off of the coast of the United States with no time to respond or give warning or maybe response. Mm-hmm. And it's the story about trying to find that submarine and
the hunt.
It's the hunt for Red October, literally.
Yeah.
And then there's this great twist to it where the captain of the submarine of the Red October, thank you,
and several senior officers
are all going to defect because they do not want it to become a weapon of first strike.
Right.
So who's going to find her first and what happens?
Yeah.
Yes.
And you know, part of the reason for Ramius finally deciding to defect is the death of his wife, right? I think she ended up, she had like appendicitis or something.
Yeah.
She had appendicitis. The surgeon in charge
was drunk,
tried sobering up on pure oxygen. And then there was a nick something while removing the, he nicked the gallbladder.
Yeah, and she died of sepsis because the antibiotics weren't good enough, right? Because they didn't have the antibiotics that we have here. It reminded me of a couple of years ago, one of the Oscar-nominated foreign films was called Collective. Yeah. Maybe it was one of the documentaries. I don't know. It was set in Romania, and it was talking about how there was this terrible fire at this club called Collective. And a bunch of the burned victims subsequently died of infections in hospital because there was corruption in the purchasing infrastructure for getting the antibiotics that were super diluted.
And not just that, is that the surgeon who did the surgery was the son of a major political figure in Russia, and so he had absolutely no punishment for that.
Yeah.
And so as a result of this, Ramius decides that the state must be punished for this, and so that's why he wants to steal their best submarine and defect.
Yeah. All doctors are equal, but some doctors are more equal than others. Right? Yeah. And it, you know, it's a good character motivation, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, Americans can be like, well, yeah, rah rah, America, we do things better,
right?
And it's the Soviets, of course, not the Russians.
Thank you.
Yes, because the Russians are good guys. Right. Yeah. So like, you know, Colin was explaining the bones of the plot, and then you have, you know, basically all the major players trying to get into place in order to find the Red October, to either sink him. They say him in the Russian Navy instead of her.
Or sink it, if you're talking about the Americans.
Yes, there we go. Oh, no, I think they said sink her, in the Americans did. But, you have, like Peter was saying, all kinds of views of pilots and sonar operators and, you know, SOSIS warning nets guys and, yes. And all kinds of stuff.
There's even a whole C or D plot about a Russian spy in Washington who gets caught and they're trying to counterintelligence
Yeah. Well, and there's the whole how do we, if we want to keep this submarine, we need it to make it look like it sank, so find something similar size, scuttle it and add some Red October stuff onto it.
It's a great suspense novel. It's a real thriller, but I have to say that because Tom Clancy wants to go into so much detail, the suspense really isn't in the mystery of what's going on. What are all these different clandestine operations?
Right.
The mystery and the thrill comes from not knowing what's going to happen next, because he gives you an objective perspective as the reader, which reveals all the players and all their motivations immediately. So it's a very different kind of twist on a suspense novel, one that I don't think is too effective, and I didn't enjoy it for that reason, but it's at least where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Perhaps for the listener who is maybe not familiar with kind of the basics of submarine operations and tactics, maybe we could explain what exactly Red October is as a type, as a variant of the Typhoon class submarine.
Yeah. So
basically, if you're not into submarines, you'll think it's just another submarine, but a, Typhoon submarines are real, and they are actually the largest submarines ever constructed. These things are like 48,000 tons submerged displacement. They're like 564 feet long, and they're like almost twice as wide as the U.S. Navy's largest submarine. Now, there are two basic kinds of submarines, which are attack submarines like USS Dallas in the film, a Los Angeles-class submarine that's stalking Red October. And then you have Red October herself, which is a ballistic missile submarine. Or a boomer, yep. The whole point of a ballistic missile submarine or a boomer is to go out, hide in the water, and be ready to get orders to launch its nuclear weapons. So had, you know, World War III and a nuclear Armageddon never kicked off, these submarines would have been the first to fire, and basically we would have mutually assured destruction. And to give you some perspective, an Ohio-class ballistic missile submarine in the United States Navy has, like, I think they used to have, like, 24 missile tubes, and each of these missiles have, like, 8 to 10 nuclear warheads in them apiece. There's enough nuclear firepower in one of these to obliterate a good chunk of the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe the Hunt for Red, I believe the Red October in the book carries 26 missile tubes. Is that correct?
I don't recall the number exactly. Okay. So
yeah, I think it did have more.
Yeah, more than enough.
Enough to get the job done.
Yeah. Well, if you want to know what enough is, there's a recent, nonfiction, I guess you would call it. No, it's called Nuclear War, a Scenario. It's presented essentially like a novel, but it just goes, you know, on the entire timeline. And it just, it takes about 20 minutes for basically everything can be completely screwed. but the terrifying thing about the submarines as a launch vehicle for nuclear weapons is, like, we know where the silos are. Right. We know where the air bases are and where the naval bases are. Right. You don't necessarily know where the sub is, and it can just pop up out of the water and launch.
Yep.
Especially if it has a new propulsion technology that's undetectable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Apparently not undetectable, right?
Well,
yeah.
Which I always thought was ironic in this book and the movie, is they were talking about, like, switching to the silent drive. I'm like, submarines' drives are already pretty silent. That's the whole point.
Mm-hmm. Even like, more okay. Silent, James. It's the whale humping drive.
Right.
It's at least unfamiliar.
The
sonar technicians.
Yeah, that would be the particular boon, right? It's unfamiliar, unknown. It hasn't been previously recorded.
Yeah, the secret is that the Hunt for October is actually powered by a magma displacement.
Yes.
Now, the interesting thing is, and we can talk about the magnetohydrodynamic, which I can't believe I got out in one try.
Nice call. Nice job.
A couple of years ago on April Fool's, there was like a Scientific American or something article about that they had a breakthrough with it.
Yeah. But that brings up the question.
Yeah.
Is this book, I talked about how it's called military lit, right? Mm-hmm. But is it science fiction? Is the book science fiction?
I mean, I think so, just because we don't, I mean, the technology is real, right? You can actually accelerate water that is conductive, right? It is possible to accelerate it, but not on this scale.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and in the book, it doesn't have a magnetohydrodynamic drive.
It doesn't?
It's an impeller tunnel drive.
It's an impeller tunnel drive.
Yeah.
And so if the technology is totally plausible,
mm-hmm.
and no one's just built it yet, is this really science fiction?
Well, I mean, building it out to the scale that you would need to propel one of the largest submarines, you know, and keep it silent, because you can still, like, when accelerating water, if you accelerate it too fast, right, you can see the differences in your faucet, or on a hose between running it really fast and not, right? You end up with laminar flow or turbulent flow, and turbulence makes noise.
Yeah. Right.
So, I don't know, maybe I can't really speak terribly intelligently about the physics behind this because I'm not a physicist or an engineer, but I've spoken with people who are physicists and even maybe our local electronics mate can talk about this a little bit more. But from my understanding, magnetohydrodynamic propulsion is a real thing. And I believe in my research, it has been tested, at least according to Wikipedia, the best of all information sources, by the Japanese. A Japanese company developed a concept that actually works, and they got this ship called the Yamato 1 up to like 8 knots or something. Mm. So, but the problem is, from what I've read, is that water itself has a very weak magnetic dipole. So in order to take something like a Typhoon submarine, in fact, even bigger than the normal Typhoon submarine, and accelerate it up to, like, say, maybe 25 plus knots, that you would need an enormous amount of energy. It would not be energy efficient. It would not be quiet at all. And it would produce a huge amount of noise. And furthermore, like, it would produce a huge magnetic signature that what submarine, anti-submarine forces would be using magnetic anomaly detectors or MAD. Any aircraft flying over that submarine will easily find it. So whether or not this thing would really be all that stealthy is pretty debatable. But like you said, in the novel, they use an impeller. It's a tunnel drive, so it could be quieter. But again, that's kind of the whole gist of whether or not this is science fiction. It's science fiction in that it's quiet, but realistically, it is an actual concept.
The interesting thing is that in the book, the Caterpillar is limited to 10 to 12 knots. In the movie, they reference going 25 to 30 through Red Route 1. Mm-hmm. And so that's it kind of goes to the interesting question of adding more science fiction in the adaptation in the original, which kind of reminds me of you guys just covered No Escape.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which is another
Don't remind us.
Sorry. I had to suffer through that movie too, Seth. That's okay. Yeah. So it's this interesting thought about people wanting to adapt something and realizing this isn't science fiction enough. Let's throw in some large words.
Sure, sure. So it is interesting too in a novel like this that veers on hard science fiction, if you want to call it science fiction, that there is a little hand wavium, you know, applied about it. It works, yada yada, whatever. It works.
It's the level of hand wavium.
Right. Increase the hand wavium for adaptation. Yeah.
Full power ahead.
Yeah. I figured that between, you know, the amount of hand wavium for both the mechanical and the magnetohydrodynamic. And it's almost an alternate history at that point. You know, it references things that used to happen in the past. And as you stay in what's called the Ryan verse, there are calls back and forward to things that happened in the real world versus happened in the Ryan verse. But yeah, it's almost an alternate history telling.
Nice. Anything else we want to talk about the novel?
One of the things that strikes me about the novel, and we've mentioned the huge number of plots, is just how few things are purely hero-driven.
Yeah.
You know, like the classic one is in Indiana Jones. Right. If you pull out Indiana Jones, everything still happens without him. Mm-hmm. The recovery of the Red October is a sequence of things that happen that start at the beginning of the book and all end at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. If you took out one or two of them, it did not work. Mm-hmm. And one person was not driving and coordinating anything on either side.
Right. Jack Ryan touched off the whole thing, right? Because he involves Skip Tyler,
right?
And he, I thought it was fun that that he needed some time on a Cray, because I used to work with Cray, which was fun. They are now part of Hewlett Packard Enterprise.
That's funny. Well, I mean, the whole thing was a military operation, right? Which takes a whole lot of people to conduct. And
it was multiple nations too,
right? Yeah. And if one part of that thing fails, it's very likely the whole thing will. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but on the other hand, there are things like there's the submarine that pushes its engines too hard and melts down, right?
Right.
And one of the sailors survives and ends up in a hospital.
Well, I mean, that is one of the things where that's one of the many subplots that probably could have been.
Right, yeah. Right. If you wanted to abridge it, you could pull
all that out. Which did get abridged for the movie.
Yes, say. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So.
One of my favorite moments in the book was actually the section that involved that nuclear reactor meltdown. And
this was the Alpha class submarine, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Which probably wouldn't have actually happened.
Why not?
They didn't have the right nuclear reactor for it.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah. I don't believe it was a high pressure. First of all, it's not a pressurized water reactor. I think they used. They use lead or something like that for? Yeah. Liquid lead cooling. Yeah, to move the power around, I suppose. What's the word I'm thinking of? For the heat transfer. There you go. Yeah.
Now, you aren't telling us anything that we're going to have to scrub off this recording or come visit you in jail about?
No. That's all public knowledge. You can go look it up on Wikipedia. Yeah.
So I did have a couple questions for James. Sorry, Tim, did I?
I did want to talk a little bit more about that moment. And
okay, what, yeah, go for it.
Sure.
That part of the book was actually one of the parts that I really got into and that actually evoked real emotional reactions from me, which I found to be quite rare. Nice. Through my read through of the book. And I like that moment, regardless of the realism of it. I like that narratively it happens as a natural consequence of the choices that the Russian Navy makes,
right?
Because it's, you know, they want to chase Remus at all costs. Right. And that really contrasts to a part of the book that I also hate, which is an accident that happens later. Mm-hmm. And it allows Tom Clancy to make Jack Ryan the hero, which goes back to what my dad was saying. So
yeah, I guess to that point, the fact that an accident, I guess the important part is that an accident did happen, and accidents can happen and did happen.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Not so much in the U.S. Navy, more in the Russian Navy.
Yeah.
Thankfully, the U.S. Navy did prize sailor safety over everything else, mostly mm-hmm. due to Admiral Rickover. He was like the godfather of the Navy, or father of nuclear Navy, actually.
As I like to say, it's a shame that the Soviet Navy did not have any Admiral Hyman Rakovsky on their mm-hmm. staff to ensure that the nuclear exactly. reactors were safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So one of the parts in the novel that I enjoyed was I like when there's a character that does something smart and gets rewarded for it. And so Jonesy kind of develops the track on the Red October. And this is in the movie as well. And he presents it to Mancuso, his captain, his skipper. And, you know, he kind of looks it over and he's like, all right, Jonesy just got promoted.
Right. First class. Go.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he's like, all right, you know, we're going to intercept them in 6 hours or something. He's like, go get some rack time, get yourself a shower. In fact, make it a Hollywood show. So I had to ask James about this. And you have a particular connection with the Hollywood show, right?
Mostly because I used to take them all the time.
Didn't you say
as much as possible?
Somebody nicknamed you Hollywood?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. What is a Hollywood shower?
Hollywood shower is like taking a normal shower at home. Anti-submarine shower. So I'll tell you what a submarine shower is first. Submarine shower usually lasts around 2 to 3 minutes. You take like 30 seconds to a minute to get yourself wet. Turn the water off, soap up, and then that takes about a minute or so, right? Soap up. And then you turn the water back on for another 30 seconds or a minute to rinse it off. And then you're done.
Right. Because water is a finite resource on a submarine.
It's a very prized resource.
Yeah. So yeah, you're not luxuriating in the shower.
Yeah, so when you just stand there under the water for 5 minutes, you're now taking a Hollywood shower.
Yeah,
if you start taking a submarine shower at home, I guarantee you your water bill will go down.
It's true.
It's a good point.
And on a diesel electric submarine that's not nuclear powered, that water is even more mm-hmm. precious, and yeah. you might get a shower once every 2 to 3 weeks. The worst I've ever heard on USS Blueback, a former crew member said he had to go almost 8 weeks without showering.
Oh, goodness. So right now we're sitting in here and the whole place kind of smells like machine oil.
Yep, that's typical.
And diesel fuel, maybe. It would have been worse in the cases where people were going 8 weeks without a shower. Mm-hmm. You'd have been like, yeah, machine oil, man. It's like perfume.
Yeah. I think the longest we went without a shower was a week. Because there was a time where we were on mission and we couldn't make water. And we kind of ran out of water. And then there was a time where the still actually broke. Actually, on the nuclear submarine, we have two methods for making water. A distillation unit and an evaporation unit. The distillation unit is notoriously finicky, though. Mm. Rarely works well. And there was a time, I think, something went wrong with the evaporation unit, the filtering. Couldn't fix it. We needed parts from on the shore, so we started using the still. But then the still is finicky, and so it broke. So nobody on the boat got showers for like a week because we needed the water for drinking and cooking and stuff like that. Yeah.
Interesting.
So there's probably some kind of a schedule that happens for showering. What happens if your schedule time comes up, but you're under a quiet order or an accident?
You don't
happens?
Get the shower. you just don't get the shower. Wow. Yep. You got to remember the number one point of this submarine is it is a weapon. Its priority is to, it's the mission, I guess, put it that way, over the sailor.
Yeah. So one thing I thought of, and just like a basic thing that somebody who's never been in a submarine thinks about, like when you're underway and you're, you know, you've been down underwater for a week, 2 weeks.
Oh, really? Months. Not 40, 50, 60 days?
40, 50, 60 days. How conscious are you of being underwater that whole time? Is it just in the background?
Yeah, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say that like the, this kind of comes out in the book, I think, a little bit, but, if you think about submarines, when they go underwater, they don't move anymore. You're on level ground the entire time, unless the boat's turning or changing depth. Once it trims out, though,
yeah,
you're stable. You're not moving like you would on the sea level or on the sea.
Surface fleet.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. On the surface.
Targets.
Level, right? Yeah. You're not moving like a target would.
Yes. So, Tim, you mentioned you were part of the Navy.
No,
you were not part of the Navy. I'm sorry.
Served in the Coast Guard.
Coast Guard.
Yeah.
So
I'm guessing duty stations and requirements and shower availability is quite different from a submarine.
Oh, yeah, but you just have to worry about getting seawater all over the place again. Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, we don't take seawater showers, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the easy way to think about the Coast Guard. It's like the Navy, but without the missiles, and we use white paint for our ships. Nice. So,
you want to be seen.
Well, it's benefit. Well, the story actually goes in a way. There was a rescue of a plane back in, I think it was like the 50s or something. And the Coast Guard car pulls up to this plane that had ditched in the ocean between Hawaii and San Francisco. And they pulled the survivors on board. And someone said, oh, thank goodness for the Navy. And the coasters are like, what? All right, we need something more distinguishable. So they put the red stripe on their ships.
Wow. We did flush the toilets with seawater, though. Not shower with seawater, but you flush toilets with seawater.
And then does that all go out into the sea?
Eventually, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will say that on YouTube, Smart Everyday has a really good submarine deep dive series. I think it's about an hour. It's a couple hours of videos of him spending 24 hours on a nuclear submarine in the Arctic, which I highly recommend anyone check out, too, if they're interested in that.
Yeah, that was very cool.
And also don't have a submarine docked on the river next to their city.
Right, right,
right. It's a slightly different thing being on an operational submarine versus, you know, the diesel that's parked here.
Yeah. So we're going pretty long here. So let's wrap up talking about the book. One of the problems that I have with the book is the ending is it's a little bit like the ending of The Return of the King, where like it's not just one ending. There's several endings because like they get the crew off, and then still the entire confrontation with Tupolev, where he shows up and is like, what's going on here? I smell a rat, you know?
Yeah.
And I felt like it was a little clunky, like that could have all come together a little more coherently.
Mm-hmm. Succinctly.
Succinctly, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it made perfect sense, honestly.
I mean, to me, it just reminded me of like the slasher is not really dead, you know, thing that always happens in horror movies.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that, but I didn't really find any things related to the plot that didn't make sense. Like, the reason he was staying behind is the Russians caught the Red October moving, thought it was one of the U.S.'s boomers, and said, hey, you're still in the area. You want to go sniff this out for us? We can get some good intelligence on it.
Yeah.
And then as he's going, he's like, wait a minute. This is not a U.S. ship. This is a Russian ship.
Right.
And that's how that call confrontation happens.
Yeah. And, I would not say that it didn't make sense. I just think that it just felt clunky to me in terms of the flow of the story.
Like, the transition was so clunky.
As we're kind of heading towards the movie, I thought the story for this happening made a lot more sense than it did in the movie, where he literally just appears out of nowhere as they get the people off the ship.
There is one thing in the ending that I feel like doesn't make a lot of sense, and that's, I could be persuaded otherwise, though, but I don't like that the Russian crew gets off of the Red October via the rescue submarine, because now everyone on the crew knows that the Americans have the capability to get on board the submarine. Mm. And the movie fixes this by, well, we'll get into it, but it's basically the Russian crew is a lot more out of the loop.
I don't know if this is a better question for Tim M or James. Like, was that commonplace back then? Did, I guess, the US and Russia both have the capabilities in some capacity to board the other's submarines underway?
Well, we have the DSRV, yeah.
Yeah.
If that's what you're talking about.
That wasn't hidden knowledge, right? That was kind of a...
I don't think so, because there is instances where the U.S. Navy offered to help rescue Russian submarines that had accidents.
Gotcha. Okay.
And but for by far and large, they waved this off. They didn't want us touching their stuff anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Tim might have some more stories.
You might refer to like the 2000 sinking of the Kursk, you know, where the West offered their help and Russia was like, no, you're going to find out something secret on the submarine.
Right, but exactly.
The problem is it didn't work. The Russian equipment doesn't work very well. And the DSRV, you know, it stemmed from a black project and from like the Navy labs or something. Right. But it's designed as a rescue vehicle, from my understanding. It's not really meant to do like clandestine operations. It just happened to be used in this way in the book and in the film. So, but I mean, hey, if it's there, they could use it. But again, it's Clancy's version. Like, hey, here's something new. Here's the newest toy. The Navy
throwed in. Yeah.
I like how they also mention it getting to the East Coast on a C-5 Galaxy.
Yeah,
there's the whole. Totally unnecessary.
No, you got to show how things get from point A to point B, Tim.
Yeah. Well, we get the the Pogi getting going out of its way to get back to port to load up on the DSRV.
Yeah.
The right. captain's unhappy because he gets fresh food, but he has to carry four more men.
Yeah, like I said, you could plot this out on a board, and I'm convinced you could move all the ships exactly, and like it is laid out logically.
Yeah. Going back to the number of plots, I remember reading this a couple times ago, and I tried keeping track, and I think I lost count around 15 plot lines or different plot threads that happened throughout the course of this book.
Yeah, and like Omzi Tim said, that's just what I'm going to call Omzi Tim?
We call him Tim Elliott.
Is you know, Clancy's writing did improve, and so by the time you get to something like Red Storm Rising, there's like an A plot and a B plot, and that's basically it. There's still some stuff that goes on, you know, off to the sides where that sets off the war and that kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. for the most part, he stays with kind of two groups of people. And, you know, obviously the problem with an A plot and a B plot is if the A plot works much better than the B plot, then, you know, you've got somebody impatient to get back to the A plot, which definitely does happen a couple times in Red Storm Rising, but yeah, he improved as a writer.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're making a movie though, having so many plots, gives you the opportunity to kind of pick and choose what you want to keep, what you want to condense.
Yeah.
And the movie does an absolute ton of condensing. You know,
yes.
I feel like every podcast I bring up that Stephen King rule of thumb, right? 122 right. pages is a feature length movie. Well, this book is 380.
So this should be three movies?
three movies. I still want to see somebody making an actual canonical book adaptation of this.
You want a 10 episode series?
There should be a 16 episode series. Just do a singles limited TV series, just Hunt for Red October, straight adapted.
18 days.
Yeah. I could see them remaking this as a series with the, you know, what's his face? Jim Krim, blah, blah.
John Krasinski.
Yeah.
Cross him with Jim Halpert from the
office? Probably. Yes, Jim Halpert. That's right.
That gets me too.
with that series of Jack Ryan folks, right?
I was going to play a game of name a Jack Ryan actor and see how many, see if we could get them all, see who would fail.
What, three?
Five.
Who's the four? Five?
Okay, now we actually need to do it.
We got
to
do it. Okay, so all right, first, so James started. So one person at a time.
All right, so Jim Halpert.
All right. One, you name me one actor only, John please, Colin.
No, John Krasinski.
One actor only.
Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck, all right.
Oh, wow. I forgot about him.
Harrison Ford.
Yep. Harrison Ford, that's three. All right, I will get one of the mystery ones. Chris Pine.
Really? When?
Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
What is that?
That's right.
It is a movie. It is definitely a movie.
I forgot about that movie.
Then Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin, yeah.
Okay, that's the fifth.
That's the fifth.
Yeah. Gotcha.
All right, so yeah, let's go ahead and move on to the movie 1990. So this is John McTiernan at the peak of his powers. You know, he did Die Hard and Predator.
Yeah.
And this. And
all the other movies we somehow, love and cherish.
Somehow the Rollerball remake as well.
Nobody's perfect. Doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, guy got to eat, so.
Okay.
So yeah, when we were watching this other day on at Colin's house, and just looking at the cast, and just like, man, James Earl Jones, and Alec Baldwin,
it's
Sean
stacked.
Connery, and Sam Neill,
star studded,
Gates McFadden,
right for five seconds, a little longer than the blueback was in it.
She did get higher billing.
yeah, she did. And English for some reason, I guess they hadn't gotten the memo that she was American.
Yeah,
they lived in England, so.
Yeah.
Sam
Neill.
Sam Neill.
Oh, yeah. Tim Curry.
Dr. Grant shouldn't have left John Montana. Glenn.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Scott Glenn. Yeah, Stellan Skarsgård, right?
Scott Glenn. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Totally stacked cast.
Yeah. I honestly can't imagine the movie any other way. It's so perfectly cast. Every actor just steals every scene.
Don't forget Vice Principal Rooney from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
That's right. Jeffrey Jones.
It would sound like whales humping or something.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, like you were talking about, and I think it was A.O. Scott, who's a film critic. You know, when I remember reading something from him, I need to look it up, see if I can find it, where he was, one statement they had in there was, the best you can hope for with a film adaptation of a book is a skillful abridgment.
Yeah.
Because it's a shorter form. And so, you know, the book is kind of sprawling, right? And it's 500 pages or so. But what I find about the movie, it's not super short. It's like 220, right?
Yeah.
For 1990, that was a pretty long movie. But it's economical, the way things are handled. It consolidates the plots. It simplifies it so you have a clear kind of...
It doesn't watch like a 2.5 hour movie, though.
It doesn't, no. Yeah. It goes by briskly. But but just like in the first scene with Skip Tyler, just the shorthand of... Skip Tyler saying, you know, how's your back? Right. And it's a seed for later talking about the chopper accident.
Yeah. Right.
You have all kinds of those things where they plant this little seed and then they come back to it. And I thought that was really good.
Yeah. Skip Tyler also mentions the magma displacement.
Right.
Which is just such great foreshadowing. The
magma displacement drive.
Yeah. The movie is really economical, but it doesn't shy away from any of the details that nod back to the book. So after reading the book, the movie really rewards a second watch when you pay attention and you realize, oh, wait, every single character that gets mentioned in the movie can be found in the book, except for Seaman Beaumont. Oh. That's the only one.
Right. You need him so that Jonesy can do his exposition about saps. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's my job? I make Jonesy look smart. Mm-hmm. I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that scene with Skip Tyler, too, just, you know, the little thing about why, you know, they really made this, right? And then he's like, you know, when I was 12, I helped my daddy build a bunker in our backyard.
Right.
Because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he really sets the stakes of that. And like Peter was talking about, for people who didn't grow up in the Cold War, that kind of sets you in that, oh, this is dangerous.
Yeah. There are really two main differences or axioms of difference between the book and the film. There's the condensing kind of change, mm-hmm. which is just a change in the plot. And then there are changes in the plot for the sake of the movie achieving a more effective tone. So the movie gains a lot more suspense and momentum by concealing Ramius's motivation in the first act. Whereas in the book, you get an immediate biography on Ramius, and you know that his plan is to exact revenge on the Soviet Union by defecting and delivering this Soviet property and new technology over to the US.
Right.
But at the beginning of the movie, it's uncertain, and he just looks like a scary Russian.
A scary Scottish Russian.
Right. So an Egyptian accent.
And a magnificent toupee. So.
He's not Russian, he's Lithuanian.
Yeah, so, Omzi, Tim, let's hear, you know, we haven't heard from you about your relationship with the movie.
Yeah, so I grew up with this movie. I think I had a good friend who was basically studying electrical engineering when he was like 8 years old. I think he's a member of Mensa nowadays, but like he loved this movie. And so every time he was over at my house, he always watched it. And I, being the little like 8 year old Tim that I am, you know, I didn't get it, you know. But over time, I've grown to really appreciate this movie. It's very much kind of a thinking man's thriller and a very thinking man's action movie. You kind of have to get a good vibe on what submarines are and how they work, basically, to really appreciate it, I think. Because if you're just thinking like, oh, well, isn't this more action-packed if we're like used to nowadays? And I don't know how many of you kind of watch YouTube movie reactions, you know, people reacting to movies, kind of like you're vicariously watching the movie again for the first time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just don't get it.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, this is... wait, so what's Ramius trying to do? Wait, why do they do that? And I've seen one person react to it who had no way related to the U.S. Navy or in the military or anything. And they were getting like all the plot points and all the nuances of the characters. And so that was interesting. One interesting thing I just read is the original choice for Ramius was not Connery. It was Klaus Maria Brandauer. Who was starred with Connery in other films like the unofficial James Bond, Never Say Never Again. He was the villain. Mm. He was in him with the Russia House, and I think maybe one other. But anyway, and I thought like, yeah, although I see Connery as the ultimate Ramius, I think Klaus Maria Brandauer would have done a really good job playing a Russian, I think.
Because
Connery, he's obviously not even bothering with attempting an accent, right. Probably for the better.
I love that.
But
it's a foreign enough accent to American ears.
But and then of course, you know, we have Alec Baldwin, who I feel Alec Baldwin is, I like him more as Ryan than I do Harrison Ford. When I think Ford, I think Indiana Jones and Han Solo.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Ford is not really great as an everyman. I think that's what Ryan is supposed to be, just kind of this lowly CIA analyst. And I think Baldwin does a lot better. But other people in talks to be Ryan were Kevin Costner. I think
that might have been
interesting. Yeah. It depends on how much you like Kevin Costner and how much you think of a character actor he is. I think he could have pulled it off, but I think Baldwin really did it well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This really was a breakout role for Alec Baldwin. I think he was probably only known for Beetlejuice before that. And one of the main, it really works for the plot in that Jack Ryan is not an action star, right?
Right.
He's just a bookish guy who did have a little bit of army or military service.
Marine service.
That's where his character growth comes from.
But yes. And,
there's a real fish out of water sense with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really enjoy how he keeps saying, next time, Jack, write a memo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that happens a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
Getting into the helicopter, the helicopter that crashed.
My favorite bit character in the movie is the guy like, you don't like flying, huh, Commander? You know, that whole monologue about industrial weight puke.
Should I find that monologue? I can read it word for word again.
No.
I genuinely thought about showing up to this at the half-eaten chocolate bar and offering it to people while recording this. This is kind of backtracking a little bit.
Yeah. This is what we do.
Yes, I know. So we talked about this being a Christmas story.
It is.
Right. Yeah.
Christmas as an event is mentioned several times. Jack hopes to do some Christmas shopping for his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The other nice thing about the book is that it's laid out by date. So we talked about this book takes place over 18 days.
Yes.
So today not is date, December 9th. Day. You want to know what happened on December 9th in the book?
What happens?
Jack Ryan flies to the Kennedy, briefs the Admiral there, flies to the Invincible. Tupolev gets the memo that they need to hunt down Ramius. So that's in there. Jonesy uncovers the Caterpillar drive. Dallas radios for clearance to leave their station and go to the end of Red Route 1.
Nice.
And the first radiation leak on the Hunt for Red October is discovered.
Mm.
Wow.
Pretty eventful day.
Pretty eventful day. And that is kind of day 7?
And we recorded a podcast aboard the Blueback.
Exactly. I thought that Tim actually gave me the idea a couple of days ago. So thanks for that.
Fun.
Yeah, the 7th day. Thursday, mm-hmm. December 9th. Actually, it's written 9 December because Clancy's an idiot.
It's a Monday for us because it's 40 years later.
Yes. So.
Right.
I love the way the movie is directed. The way the camera moves and even the way they use the subtitles at times. Because when they first... kind of are introducing the Red October crew. You know, they come down from on top of the conning tower. And somebody says to Ramius, the political officer is in your quarters or something.
Yeah.
Right? And the way, but it divides it.
Which would never happen on a U.S. submarine.
it divides it into two statements and they're on different sides of the screen. And it just kind of gives you that because it's the political officer is in your room. Right. And the way it divides it, that it just like it says we don't trust this guy. That's from a directorial choice. That's just what that says to me. It's like we're suspicious of this guy.
The subtitles are used as a narrative tool.
Mm-hmm.
First as the introduction when you're on the Russian sub, and then you get to know the characters and they start speaking your own language. Right. And then again at the end, where Ramius finally meets the Americans and they have to broker peace, and it's very uncertain, so they go back to using subtitles. Patrick Willems has a very good analysis of this on YouTube, and it's really interesting on how the subtitles were used as a narrative tool.
I don't think they use subtitles for that. For the section where the Americans first meet the crew, I didn't think they use subtitles for that. I thought it was just them talking in Russian.
Well, yeah, they use it. Yeah. That's the first time it is, right? Where they're just talking to each other in Russian, and then when the engineer says he's turning green, that's when they start showing this.
Okay, because I don't remember seeing one for something about a cowboy, because that's completely that's just Jack translating that,
right?
Because it's a cognate.
Yeah. Buckaroo. Yes. Yes. Buckaroo.
Yeah. You need to do like the weird like.
Well, like interesting enough, Armageddon is the same word in both languages. Mm-hmm. And so there's this nice, you know, they're having Russian with subtitles and then he says Armageddon and that's the same. And from there on out, it's English and they're saving money on their budget.
That's what made it a great, transition point, I think.
Yeah.
Because they're the same word.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed that switch over.
And the zoom in.
Yeah.
And,
That was really well done. And even like a scene like the, when Jonesy is presenting his thing to Captain Mancuso, which of course, and it's accurate. He's not actually a captain. He's the captain of the boat, but his rank is commander, right?
Right.
Which would be typical. He's got the little silver leaf.
Mm-hmm.
When Jonesy marks off, you know, that like I saw him here, then I saw him here, and it's on the chart. And then he puts the ruler up there. And watching the movie, I commented the other day that, you know, Captain Mancuso already knows where that ruler's pointing, but the audience doesn't. And so it slowly draws out with the marker that kind of fades in and out, which I thought was interesting. But the camera pans along with it so that you are kind of taking that journey of discovery there that it is going to Thor's twins.
One particular note of that scene, actually, that I really like is the use of the sound of the caterpillar that Jonesy has discovered.
Yeah.
It almost acts like diegetic music and heightens the tension of that scene. He plays it, and it sounds like this low harmonic rumble, like this wong, you know. But it sounds like it's music, but it's not. And you're like, oh, that's actually a noise. Now listen to it at 10 times speed.
Yeah.
And then you get the regular rhythm, and you realize, oh, it's man-made.
Yeah. Could have led with that, but...
The movie is so good at storytelling. Yeah. I like to think that the movie is really the spirit or the animus of the book. And so it's really easy to get invested to, whereas the book is kind of the intellect and it'll go into all the gross details about everything that's going on. And so it's interesting in that way, but I really enjoy the movie in that way.
One thing that bothers me, is the signal lamp communication in the film. It's way too fast. So apparently this Red October surfaces, right, after having the radiation leak, quote unquote, and they immediately get discovered by, the frigate, the Reuben James, and he starts signaling to him with a lamp. And he's like, Red October, halt and stay where you are. And I'm like, whoa, this is the fastest signalman in the whole U.S. Navy, and this Russian is really good at reading Morse.
The movie is definitely not realistic. It definitely accelerates certain things for pace. You can see the when they're doing the dead reckoning, the timer is making certain jumps in time, and you can see that pretty clearly. So it's definitely, you can't call it totally realistic. And
obviously it's for the audience's convenience, it just seems like really
even when Ryan is dictating what to send to Ramius over with Morse, there's no way that he's doing those words that fast,
right?
each one of those little sequences of dots is a letter, not a word.
It would have definitely been more sparse language.
It's dimensions of playmate of the month. That's easy to send.
That's digits. Dad pointed something out when we were watching this, which is when Jack is writing on a notepad, says he needs a map, goes to the map, finds what he's talking about, then immediately gives the notepad to Mancuso, says, here, type, send this.
Yeah.
Never.
He didn't really show him ever write anything down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's not interested in doing that. Yes. My favorite change, actually, from the book is that in the book, his wife died while he was in port, whereas in the movie they have her die while he's at sea, and that just there's that really good scene, the really tense scene, the crazy Ivan scene, where
it's silent.
Yeah, where Jonesy is almost on him, right, and has almost caught him, and he and Borodin are talking, and he says, 40 years at sea, I widowed her the day I married her. And he says, he comments, a war with no battles, no monuments, only casualties, which I think is just a great encapsulation of the stupidity of the Cold War and, nuclear brinksmanship and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The dialogue is really beautiful.
Yeah.
If you want to believe that he's the war-weary guy that really does not want a war to happen, it's totally convincing.
Yeah.
And Ramius sells it Sean Connery sells Ramius with his performance there.
He does, despite not trying to do an accent, which I love. it's funny because you would think maybe from a director's standpoint, you'd be like, okay, everybody, we're not doing Russian accents. We don't have to have Harrison Ford's terrible one in K-19 The Widowmaker.
Right. You, Tom Hanks.
Yeah. You don't have to have Keanu Reeves trying an accent in Bram Stoker's Dracula. It doesn't work out, right?
No.
And so he doesn't do anything, but then Sam Neill does. There's a couple times where he says a word, and I'm like, that was completely Australian the way he pronounced it. But then several of the other crew are actually Russian or Eastern European. And so they have their normal accents, which is, it's totally fine. But I like something like Chernobyl, the recent series where almost everybody's British of some kind except Stellan Skarsgård, we know they're not speaking English, they're speaking Russian, and so it's okay if they don't speak English with a Russian accent,
right? Well, all European people speak English with a Russian accent, and all Americans know this.
Yes.
Yeah. We're forgetting the best accent in the movie, which is just Tim Curry going, but Captain! I love that line. It's my favorite line of the entire movie.
I love his performance. Pouty. So that one man may arm the missiles. Yes.
It just seems like he's just throwing darts on the board. It's like, I'm impersonating that country and now this country.
Oh, I didn't ever hear him really go for an accent. He just sounded like Tim Curry to me.
Yeah. Yep. I was speaking of favorite lines. I love Van Pelt's line. I'm a politician, which means when I'm not kissing babies, I'm stealing their lollipops.
Yes.
And I told the boys, and I completely forgot about this. I was going to have lollipops for us all for this. It's like, I got us onto a submarine. I guess that's going to have to be enough for
now. Yeah, we'll let it slide. I love that actor's performance. And this is one of the changes from the book, too, right? Jack actually briefs the president. Right,
president.
Right? Yeah. But in a movie, you know, like having a fictional president on screen...
It breaks the suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, a little bit. And so I like just having him brief the Joint Chiefs and that kind of stuff. And I love that moment where Greer's like, I said, speak your mind, Jack, but Jesus.
This movie is full of so many, it's a quote, gold mine, one ping only, Vasily, right?
Yes.
Or most things in here don't react well to bullets.
The bullets, yes.
Yeah. And we have to forget, we can't forget the best line in the book, which is, Russians don't take a dumb song without a plan.
Yes, yes. From future Senator Fred Thompson.
Yeah. My bad, movie.
Movie.
Yeah.
On our text thread that we had going when this was in the works, Tim at some point said, personally, I give us one chance in three.
We need some buckaroo.
Yes.
That's kind of my thing that I do for this podcast is I swing big. Mm-hmm. I've gotten some incredible guests, some incredible letters,
mm-hmm.
and now we've been on an incredible submarine. So thank you very much.
Yeah,
of course. I want this on the record. He stated he doesn't know if he can top this, so I just want that stated in the podcast.
This would be a hard one to top.
This
is true.
Well, we are sitting around the wardroom table, so just imagine it's Connery and a bunch of British actors portraying Russian officers. Personally, I give us one chance in three.
Yes. Yep.
Going back to watching the movie, reading the book, I definitely imagine some scenes from the book taking place in the blueback, just because I've been on here.
Mm.
I think I've done the basic submarine tour 5 or 6 times, and I've seen videos, I've seen pictures of it. So it's one of those, like, I can imagine something taking place at the table we're sitting at right now. I can imagine going to the captain's stateroom and having Jonesy tell him about different things. It's just really cool that we're actually here for this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so surreal. It's such an opportunity, and we're really grateful for it.
Yeah.
Anyways, movie talk.
Yeah. Other thoughts on the movie?
I absolutely hate that line, Dad. I'm a politician.
That's such a great line.
I cannot stand that line.
It's exactly the kind of smarmy line a politician would use to get somebody.
It's brilliant.
Because he's basically saying it's his way of getting Ryan on board.
Yeah, right. I need somebody there to hedge my bets, and that's the reason. But you're right, and he doesn't come out as a great leader. He comes out as a smarmy politician.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and then all his interactions with the Russian ambassador too. You've lost another submarine.
Okay, that line is fantastic, and I think that sells the like smarmy politician more than anything he says in that briefing does. Because for me, it's the one line of the movie that takes me out of it.
You just if I could steal on your argument here, you don't like how. A character is describing their own motivations in a meta kind of way.
Using what you said from the book earlier, you don't like how the character is introduced character, here's dossier on character. It feels exactly that, and we don't get that for anyone else in the book.
Feel like the movie is allowed that for one line. I don't think it's a real break in suspension of disbelief.
It breaks the suspension for me. It's the only character we see that happen with.
And it's perfectly okay that it, you know, your mileage may vary, right?
Yeah.
For me, it totally works because this is the kind of thing that character would say.
I can see that, but I don't see that, especially given, I would rather have you show me them being a politician and getting their more smarminess throughout their other interactions with the ambassador, which we get a little bit, but nothing to the overt extent of the, I'm a politician, which means I'm not kissing babies, I'm stealing their lollipops.
Right.
But
that whole thing, you know, the rest of the quote, right? But it also means I keep my options open.
Yes.
And so that's his way of saying, I don't really believe you. But on the off chance that you're right, I need to do something about it. And my best way to do that is to send, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and I'm pretty sure that you can go out and do this.
Yeah, and here's the thing, because I think Jack has the better response to that, which is, these other guys, they're expendable? Was it, like, they're we need them, whereas you're, and then Jack says, I'm expendable.
Yeah.
And I think having that conversation, I think if you flush that conversation out a little bit better, especially playing it more as I think the book uses the analogy of, talks about how the president was a former courtroom lawyer, so you feel like he's kind of getting wrangled, and then that's when you got him.
Well, the judge, too, like the CIA head.
Judge Ritter.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I get it. There's things that stick in someone's craw and don't, you know, and work for everybody else. And that's fine. You can be the outlier. It's all right.
It's okay to be wrong.
The last thing that Van Pelt does that I absolutely love is when he has that final scene with the ambassador. And instead of the candy jar being at the front of his desk, he's picking up and eating out of it. And oh, it's yes. kind of a whole, like, thumbing his nose at the guy.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm eating yep. my candy because I got yeah. your sub and you know I have your sub. Yeah. There's not a single thing you can do about it.
Which sells... It's like I said, it's the only... Everything else, I love that character for the movie. I think it's a great distilling of two or three different characters' interactions we get in the book into one character throughout the movie. It's just that one line mm-hmm. for the rest of the movie.
James, yes. you have your own kind of gripe with this film, right? Specifically about one particular submarine technology with the torpedo countermeasures.
What? Did I?
No. Didn't you say that all those countermeasures were completely bunk and not realistic at all at one point?
They were probably advertised as more effective than they actually were.
Oh, okay, okay.
I think the best we had was like little canisters that would pop out and make noise and pretend to be a submarine. But
decoys.
But the torpedoes are way smarter than that.
Yeah. So what do you think? Science fiction or not?
I think the science fiction was more the drive than anything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like in the Top Gun movies, right? Where they have these flares and things, right?
Right.
It's yeah. not flares. It's chaff, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But it's more cinematic for it to be flares.
Yep. Can't have chaff underwater, unfortunately.
No, not so much.
Should we do a little stats?
Go for it.
Yeah. So budget of around $30 million. Revenue of over $200.5 million, so extremely financially successful for 1990. 88% positive rating at Rotten Tomatoes.
Wait, audience or critic?
I think that's critic score.
Oh, okay.
Yep. And Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars.
Mm.
That's a stat you don't hear too often for technological action movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Won 3 awards, all had to do with sound and film editing.
Right. Yeah. And the sound editing is really good. Yeah.
This movie is best watched at a place that has a very, very good sound system.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes.
You want to mention the sound system that we heard?
So one of our family friends is a professional sound engineer and has a home theater room with a 12-foot projector screen and theater quality sound. Mm. And
nice.
The day we were helping them move into their new house, he decided to throw Hunt for October because he loved the movie up on the big screen. Nice. So Tim and I are upstairs in the theater room watching this scene. He comes back up after and goes, hey, like, oh yeah, I realized you guys had the bass on. Let's watch the last half hour of the movie with the bass turned all the way up. And our parents, you said you could hear the house shaking from outside?
No, we were underneath, we were on the first floor. You guys were on the second floor, but we were on like on opposite ends of the house. And you'd be sitting there and you'd feel it go underneath you. I mean, just an incredible setup.
Sound design for this movie is absolutely amazing.
Yep. Right. Final thoughts? From Momsy Tim?
Yeah, this movie in particular, I think probably for anyone who works on a submarine or even a submarine museum, it's something near and dear to us, particularly on Blueback, because we do have that small 4-second shot in it. But we spend all day quoting this movie and every other submarine movie out there. But as we say on Blueback as tour guides, don't watch a submarine movie with us because we inevitably start picking it apart,
right.
whether or not we are actually submariners or not. But still, I personally hold that, you know, if you want the penultimate darn near 100% accurate submarine movie, if you're looking at World War II, Das Boot.
Mm.
If you want the Cold War submarine thriller, closest you get is probably Hunt for October.
Nice. Das Boot is good. All right, rank them. Let's start with people who have microphones in front of us. So Tim, what do you think? Do you want to give a we rank the book and the movie?
Yeah, I'd say I can't remember when I ranked how many stars I gave the book. I will say the movie, I think it does a good better job of condensing a lot of the stories and some of the stuff that maybe doesn't need to be there given the medium of film. So I'd rate the film probably a 4 or 4.5 stars out of 5.
Nice.
What if you went like movie or like which would you prefer, the movie or the book?
Honestly, I really can't answer that because I'm so biased towards the film. I grew up with the film more than the book.
That's okay. I mean, we've talked about this where when you know, when we started our podcast, we were covering a bunch of stuff that everybody knew was a movie, but we didn't necessarily know it was a book. And so the movie becomes the true story to us. And then the book, you're like, oh, well, that's a weird knockoff of this movie that I love. So it's okay to prefer the movie. Unless you ask Colin.
Well, yeah. Boy, I have the same kind of problem answering. I grew up with the movie, and then I've been reading the book for 30 years or so. I think the movie does it better because it reaches a larger audience. But the book, that particular book, was the foundation of the Ryan universe that we've had with, I want to say there's 40 novels from 5 different authors, video games, board games, movie franchises, television adaptations. It was huge. So I almost like, how can you not rank the book? I mean,
when it gets around to me, I'll tell you.
Okay.
So book, movie?
I think I'd have to go book, movie, but it's a hard one.
Yeah. All right. I'm going movie, book, though.
All right. How about you, Peter?
I am going book over movie, and I absolutely love this movie. I watched the movie first, and so for me, that was the standard. But having that book with how much it expands on the conflict and really sells, like I said earlier, how tense the whole Cold War was.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't even come close to that.
Okay. It's interesting. I mean, it reminds me of stuff your dad says where, like, well, there's something that I really love in this movie and the book does more of it. So I prefer the movie. Where then there's other times where it's like, I didn't really like what was in the book and the movie did it shorter. So I like the movie better. How about you, Tim?
I was going to say, just remember before you answer that I am driving you home. So the correct answer could be a very important...
Wait, you're driving me home too.
both Peter and Dad said book over movie, right?
Yes.
Well,
are you going to fall in line, Kusky?
I prefer the movie over the book. In fact, I think this might be my favorite movie of all time. Not because I think it's the best movie ever made, but I've just rewatched it so much, I can keep seeing it, like, once every week for the rest of my life.
We didn't even talk about the score.
Another thing that takes the movie to another level and makes it so much more investing and engaging for me is the movie score, which is, you know, it's by Basil Poledouris, and it includes Russian choir and lots of brass and sweeping orchestral score, and it's romantic in some parts where the submarine is maneuvering through places, and it's almost like Flight, and other times where it's really soulful and dark with the Russian choir singing full force behind it. It's got to be movie over book.
Yeah, I agree. For me, it's movie over book, and it's not particularly close. I really enjoyed the book the first time I read it, but it never came close I never had a moment of like, oh wow, that book was so much better.
This does kind of seem like a slog. What you would consider a slog book?
Yeah. And I had a hard time with this. The first number of chapters, I was like, okay, I'm enjoying this a little more than I thought I would, and then you know, inevitably there was another plot where I'm like, wait, can we get back to Jack and Marco?
If there's a time where I want to enjoy the story of The Hunt for October, but I don't have the 2 days to fully process what's going on in the book, the movie is an amazing substitute for that.
That's good advice.
And it reminds me, it's almost like a comfort watch for a lot of people, because you have that whole Comfort Read series from your other podcast. And I think there are comfort movies as well. There might be movies that you like better, but if you're talking about, man, I just want to relax and watch a great movie, that's the kind of movie that you go to.
So in any case, I feel like everybody liked everything, at least to a certain extent.
Totally.
All right. I think we're about wrapped.
Let's.
So, Tim, thank you so much for hosting us and chaperoning us here aboard the sub.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure having you guys. I was so excited that you guys could come aboard and we could do this podcast.
Yeah. Very, very cool.
Thank you. What an honor.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Let us know what you think of the book and the movie. And definitely check out OMSI. And if you're in the Portland area, do the Blueback Tour. It's very cool. We'll make sure to include all the links and details to that. And until next time, may the road rise up to meet you. And may the book always fall open to where you left off. All right. Bye, everybody.
I have two comments. One of them is a throwaway. You said tracking the magnetic signature, and that reminds me of the Clone Wars episode where they have the stealth ship.
That is a throwaway.
Admiral Trench, lock onto that magnetic signature. I can't do the accent.
Yeah, that one's gone.
Yes, that one's gone. Sorry, that's just a random tangent. I forgot.
Yeah, I like it.
It might make it. We'll see.
We'll see.
Earlier when he said he had two things and one of them was a throwaway, now I can't keep the second one without keeping the first one. So
you just cut it all out.
Could do. We'll find out. Yes. If it goes in the blooper reel, you'll know.
I got into a whole argument with somebody about the way Americans write dates.
It's more
descriptive. Because, like, sorry, Americans say month and day because it's getting more specific as you go forward. Instead of the 31st of something, there's that brief second if you're reading a date where you don't know what month you're talking about.
Yeah, but so you know which ones they're not talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not next to the year, which is also...
I know you know that, Seth. Yes. But I don't know why I reached the mic for this. This is not making the final cut. I just wanted to get
that out there. This is definitely a blooper reel, because he's going to put in there every time you say, this isn't going to make the final cut.
Yep. And another thing. Your wish is my command.